I made the commitment to bring campaign finance reform to the floor of the House of Representatives, to get the bill out of committee on a timely basis, and to have this day as a day to debate the bill. It was very clear, if you look at the facts, and if you're intellectually honest with the facts, you'll find that the people who brought down the rules so that the bill didn't come to the floor was the Democrat leadership of the House of Representatives. Thank you very much.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert on Thursday. Campaign finance reform hit a dead end in the House. Lawmakers couldn't agree on the rules of debate. Mr. Hastert says the issue will not be back on the agenda anytime soon. NPR's Dan Shore is away this week. John Heilman of Wired Magazine joins us from Lucky Guy WPBX in Southampton, New York. Good morning to you, John.
Morning, Susan.
Pretty confusing chain of events this week on the campaign finance business. Lots of angry debate and then nothing. What happened?
Well, it was one of those Alice in Wonderland days in the House of Representatives, with the result that the advocates of reform, campaign finance reform, seemed to end up voting not to have the long-awaited debate on campaign finance reform. What happened is pretty simple, actually. The Republican leadership, which was against campaign finance reform, set up rules for debate that made it more likely that the reform measure would, in fact, fail. It was on shaky ground to begin with. Seeing that, the reform advocates decided that the risk of accepting the rules and losing on the floor was much greater than the risks of pulling the bill and never seeing it return to the floor. Now, the Democrats and Republicans are both trying to make this a partisan issue. You heard Speaker Hastert there claiming that this is all the Democrats' fault. The Democrats are saying it's all the Republican leadership's fault. As usual, the situation's a little more complicated than that. You had a lot of strange bedfellows here. On one hand, though, it's true that the Republican leadership led the way in striking the blow against reform. There was a lot of nervousness on the Democratic side, particularly among blacks and Hispanics who rely on soft money, which is what this bill sought to ban, to win against better-financed Republican opponents. On the other side, there are a number of prominent Republicans who are among the reformers. Of course, John McCain, the most prominent, but 19 Republicans voted against Speaker Hastert on this procedural bill, on this procedural move. So, you know, this sort of shows the truth again is that, you know, campaign finance reform is less a partisan issue than an issue of who's in control. Back in 1993 and 1994, some of these same Democrats, including Dick Gephardt, used the same kinds of procedural pedophagy to keep campaign finance reform from passing then when they were in control. Yeah. Now Republicans are in control and they don't want to see the system changed either.
Well, does this impasse mean that reform is dead?
I think it probably is dead. There's a very narrow window. We've heard about some of the guerrilla tactics and really even more arcane procedural maneuvers that the supporters of reform will try to bring out. They have a very narrow window, September, October, after they come back from their summer recess. And if they don't get it done in that period of time, it won't happen because we're then into an election year. And the idea of campaign finance reform in an election year is pretty much like hell freezing over. I think that the truth for reform is that the only time campaign finance reform will ever pass is when it seems like there's actually a cost to voting against it. And so far, although the public says it favors reform, it doesn't favor it enough to actually throw people out who stand in reform's way.
Yeah. Stem cells still in the news this week and still no decision from the White House about research on them. But there were some very significant research developments this week, and maybe they would influence the administration's thinking.
Yeah, huge news in the world of science. As is so often the case, the scientific world just keeps leapfrogging and racing ahead of public policy and the political debate. So far, the stem cell debate has been over research on stem cells that are derived from embryos that are frozen in fertility clinics and that are going to be destroyed in any case. Now we learn that a facility in Virginia is creating embryos explicitly for the purposes of stem cell research, and even more explosively up in Massachusetts, there's a biotech company that plans to start creating embryos for stem cell research through the use of really sophisticated cloning technology. Both of these developments, I think, turn the heat up on this debate enormously, partly because of the fact that it's no longer a question of weighing just advances for science against embryos that would otherwise be wasted. But also because it touches on the cloning issue, which is such an incredible, incredible cultural hot button. And you could see this week passions inflamed to an even much greater degree than they have been before.
Absolutely. Think George W. Bush could possibly have known during the campaign that this issue was going to dog him like this?
God, this issue reminds me of nothing so much as Bill Clinton in 1993 and the gays in the military issue,
yes.
Where, you know, he made this promise during the campaign in order to satisfy a narrow but very vocal constituency, gay rights advocates. In Bush's case, it's social conservatives and anti-abortion activists. You make this promise. It's not very close to the centerpiece of your campaign. It seems like a marginal peripheral issue. And then, boom, in your first year, it suddenly comes out of nowhere and suddenly has become almost a defining issue for Bush. It's a, as I said before, a hot button issue. The Republican Party is actually quite split on it. And because of the passions involved, a compromise that satisfies anyone is going to be incredibly hard to find.
Yeah. Talking about military policy now, the military is reportedly going to drop a fundamental strategic doctrine. It is that this country should be able to fight two major wars on two different fronts simultaneously, as we did in the Second World War. How come the Pentagon's behind an idea like this, and what does it mean?
Well, you know, Defense Chief Don Rumsfeld has been engaged in a pretty thoroughgoing review of strategic doctrine and how the Pentagon runs. One of the first results of that review. The explicit rationale is that, you know, the world has changed. The United States faces more diffuse and more multiplicitous set of threats, terrorism, chemical weapons, bioweapons, rather than being confronted mainly with Russian ICBMs, and it gives the military for the first time, it says, you know, you'll only have to fight one big war, but also you have to be able to fight containment wars in a lot of small theaters. So the explicit rationale is that, you know, the world has changed. The less explicit rationale is that it creates a kind of doctrinal justification for the missile shield defense. And one of the things this policy shift does is it says that defending the American homeland is now an explicit priority, and that's pretty much a very clear way of saying, you know, this is why we need to have our missile shield. And, you know, that's the Bush administration's first defense priority, as you know.
Yeah, well, and today over the Pacific Ocean, the Pentagon's testing a component of the missile defense system. So is that not a violation, though, of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty 1972?
Well, I think Democrats would say that the entire Bush policy seems to be headed in direct confrontation with the ABM treaty. This week, the Bush team, Paul Wolfowitz from the Defense Department, laid out for Congress in a much more explicit and detailed way than they ever have before just how fast they intend to push this this missile defense system. As I say, Democrats object on the basis of the ABM treaty. The Bush administration says, yes, you're right. They're very open about it. They say it does run smack up against the ABM treaty, and that's why they say that the ABM treaty needs to either be amended or scrapped. The question is how well this is going to play with Vladimir Putin and Russia, who are who obviously want to see the ABM treaty kept in place. Bush and Putin are meeting this week at the G8. The last time they met, they got along very well. This issue will be at the top of their conversation. You wonder whether they're going to continue to have such cordial relations as they did last time.
Sure. Finally, John, Beijing hosting the 2008 Olympics, the decision from the International Olympic Committee. Today in China, the American scholar Li Xiaomin convicted of spying. Is this all a coincidence, or what is it? What else does it tell us?
Well, the two events happening so close together, it seems almost kind of perfect kind of illustration or distillation of the sort of the dilemma that the world, the West, has in figuring out how to deal with China. The world is kind of broadly divided in two camps. There are those who think that engagement is the right way to go. These are the people who are in favor of extending permanent normal trading relations to China, to bring them into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and now giving them the Olympics. And their argument is the more that China is engaged with the world, the more likely they are to conform to our standards. Mm-hmm. The other camp says China is cynical and is going to do what it wants to do, and they think you need a harder hand. The question is how to balance those interests, and it's very hard to do.
Thank you very much, John Heilman of Wired Magazine.